bottom drunks are high bottom alcoholics. And a high bottom drunk will get drunk exactly the same way a low bottom does. They believe a lie just before they take the first drink. We're going to look at an example of a guy named Fred. And Fred is a high bottom drunk. And we're going to look in old Fred's head just before he gets drunk, and he will find out he got drunk just exactly like Jim did. He believed a lie.
We have a lot of people coming in today who are like Fred. They haven't lost everything through drinking. They haven't been to jail. They haven't been divorced. They haven't been a lot of those things that we talk about. And a lot of times they come into our meetings, and then we begin to more or less try to 12-step him. And we begin to talk about 49 car wrecks and 140 years in jail and 29 wives and all that sort of thing. And Fred looks at us and says, I'm not like that. I must not be an alcoholic. Those things haven't happened to me. Well, how many jails makes an alcoholic? Zero. Has nothing to do with all those horrible stories that we sometimes tell those guys. But if we talk to them about the illness of alcoholism, we talk to them about the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, and how that works, they can identify with that. But they can't identify with our horror stories. That's why we have to need to know what the problem is. But Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married to the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearance, he's a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital he had gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting that he was an alcoholic, he told himself he'd come to the hospital to rest his nerves.
We see lots of nerve resters in AA today, just like old Freddie.
The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. Now, he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. Fred would not take step one, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem.
If you can't take one, you can't take two.
Now, we told him what we knew of alcoholism, and he was interested and could see that he had some of the symptoms.
They told him about one and two.
But he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. Now, we heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told us is most instructive, for he was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns. It was flat on his back, nevertheless. Well, let him tell you about it. He said, I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible to drink again. And I rather appreciate your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I'd learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as you fellows, most of you fellows, that I'd been usually successful in licking my other personal concerns, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident. That would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. He pulled out his willpower and said, sick and will. Now, in this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. We think Fred began to get a little drunk right here. Began to play with him. This is not as bad as they said it was. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I'd been out of time before during this particular dry spell, so there's nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Fred was doing good, wasn't he? Everything was going great. Job was good. Family was good. No reason for him to get drunk.
He said, I went to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind, it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails and go back to the hospital. Now that's the truth, isn't it? But he couldn't drink on the truth. So his mind just said it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. The insane idea that he could have a couple of cocktails before dinner and everything would be great. Now based on the insane idea, he takes some action, makes a decision and takes some action. I ordered a cocktail in my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. We got it inside ourselves now. The allergy takes over. After dinner, I decide to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. You know, Jim vaguely sensed he wasn't many too smart. Fred didn't even sense that. Fred just thought a couple of cocktails before dinner would be great, that's all. He took the two drinks, triggered the allergy, couldn't stop drinking, ends up back in the hospital again. Now, is his real problem the fact that he's got a physical allergy to alcohol? Or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol? The real problem centers in the mind, telling us we can drink, rather than the body that ensures that we can't. Let's go to page 43, last paragraph.
And it says, once more. So he's already told us about 5 or 6 times through these illustrations. That's what you talk to drunks. You tell them about 5 or 6 times, and then you tell them once more. The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Bill tried to stay sober on self-knowledge. Roland tried to stay sober on self-knowledge. Jim tried to stay sober on self-knowledge. Fred tried to stay sober on self-knowledge and couldn't do it. So he told us once more, his defense must come from a higher power. You can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. Can't think your way out of it. The more we try to think our way out of it, the deeper in it we get, because we're using a faulty tool here. So you can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind.
You notice he said the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. He didn't say the drinking alcoholic. He didn't say the practicing alcoholic. He just said the alcoholic. And what that means to me today is left on my own resources. I have no mental defense against the first drink. Doesn't make any difference how long I've been sober. And we've all known people who stayed sober in AA for years. Got away from AA, got away from the program, became insane and started drinking again. So he's talking to all of us, not just the drinking, not just the practicing alcoholic, but even those that have been sober for a number of years. Now, if I have fully read and studied this chapter, and if I can really see the insanity of alcoholism, then by the time I get to the bottom of page 43, he has now closed the door on me. And he's let me come to see that if I'm going to stay sober, I'm going to have the aid of a power greater than human power. And if you're the kind of alcoholic that I am, and if you'd been raised in the church setting that I was raised in, at the end of chapter 3, you're faced with one hell of a dilemma. Because you see, I was raised in a good old Southern Baptist church. Got nothing wrong with a good old Southern Baptist church. It was a good church then. It's a good church today. But I was a kid growing up in church. Surely they talked once in a while about a kind and a loving God. But if they did, the message never got to the pew that I sat in. Because all I remember hearing about God in the Baptist church was hellfire and brimstone. Going to hell for lying, cheating, stealing, drinking whiskey, and committing adultery. By the time I got to AA, I'd been doing that 26 years. And I knew that God had already told St. Peter, when that little four-eyed sucker gets up here, send him downstairs. I was absolutely convinced that if God had anything to do with me, it wouldn't be something good, it would be something bad. I shall never forget when I separated from God. As a kid going to that good old Southern Baptist church, they gave me the rules. They said, if you do this, this, and this, you'll be okay. If you do that, that, and that, you're going to hell just sure as anything. And I didn't have any problem with their rules at all until I got to be about 13 years old. And one day it seemed as though the minister looked me straight in the eye and he said, to think about doing it is just as bad as doing it. And I said, oh, shit. I've had it now. Because I'd been thinking about doing it for about a year. In fact, I was thinking about doing it so much I was beginning to get a little brain damage from it. And I said to myself, if you're going to go to hell for thinking about doing it, then you just might as well go ahead and do it. And I did. And I didn't go to hell immediately. And I said, those suckers, that minister, my parents and my teachers have joined together in a conspiracy to keep me from having any fun. I said, to hell with them. From this day on, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it, whenever I want to do it, and if they don't like it, they can go square to hell just sure as anything. I want nothing to do with God. I want nothing to do with parental discipline or teacher discipline. I walked away from the church, and I was 13 years old. When I came to AA, I was 40 years old. But I came to AA with a spiritual knowledge of a 13-year-old boy that was absolutely scared to death about this God thing. Thank God Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic. Because he knew just exactly how I was going to feel when I got here. And I think he said to himself, these guys are going to have to make a decision about this God thing sooner or later. And it would be impossible for them to make the decision based on their old ideas about God. And he said, maybe I better give them some new ideas about God. And if they can pick up on some new ideas, they can discard some old ideas, and then they'll be able to make a decision. And he sat down and he wrote the chapter, We Agnostics. I think it's one of the greatest pieces of spiritual information that I've ever read in my life. It allowed me to discard some of those old ideas. It allowed me to pick up some new ideas. It opened my mind to the point where I could make a decision about this God thing, and then God has proven to me since that time that He's not hellfire and brimstone, that He's a kind and a loving God. Let's look at this chapter for just a few minutes.
This chapter, We Agnostics, is a great, great piece of spiritual information, I believe. Opened up my mind and saved my life. In a way, it's been working up to this point now. We've said when we get ready to quit and we promise everybody we're going to quit, we pull out our willpower and say, second will, we're through with drinking. Now, the reason our willpower don't work is because the obsession of the mind is stronger than the will. The idea to drink is stronger than the idea not to drink. So our obsession of the mind is stronger than the will. There's only one thing that is stronger than the obsession of the mind, and that's God who made it. That's the only thing stronger than the obsession of the mind. Willpower won't work on it. And the chapter...
Tell them that, Father Ben.
Yeah, the chapter We Agnostic, we had a good friend of ours. He told Charlie and I, his name was Father Bill Wilson, really. And Father Bill was an exceptional man. When he was 15 years old, they deduced that he was a very smart young man. And they took him from Ireland to the University of Rome. And he was to study there for the next 30 years. You know he read a lot of spiritual material during those 30 years. Got 3 doctorates in the arts. Very well educated man. But he got to drinking some of the sacramental wine they had over there.
A little too much of it.
Caught him on a number of occasions. And finally they sent him away from the University of Rome. And for punishment, They sent him to La Jolla, California. Anybody ever been to La Jolla, California? One of the most beautiful cities in the world, I guess. But to punish him, they sent him over there. You see? And while he was there, he continued to drink, of course, eventually found his way into Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he read this chapter to We Agnostics, and this is what he told us. He said, this chapter, We Agnostics, is the greatest piece of spiritual information that he had ever read. Quite a statement coming from a guy like him. He said, this chapter, We Agnostics, is not put in here to teach us as any particular type of religion. In fact, it doesn't talk about religion at all. He says, this chapter, We Agnostics, is simply in here for us to ask questions about what they're talking about and to wonder about what they're talking about, what this means to me. And he said, with an open mind like that, ultimately, God will prove to you that there's a God. And when that happens, you'll have a God of your own understanding that nobody can improve upon. Bill knew that we were going to be like, a lot of us were going to be like that. The word agnostic, gnostic means knowledge. You put the ag in front of it, means without. Those of us who are without knowledge is what an agnostic is. Or those of us who were 7 or 13 years old when we come to AA, and that's our spiritual knowledge. We were agnostic. We knew that there was a God, but we had no personal knowledge about it. So therefore, I disregarded it. Bill knew that we were going to be like him. Remember, they said, when they talked of a God personal to me, my mind snapped shut against such theories. And certainly my mind did too. And remember later on it said, when the spiritual malady, when the spiritual illness is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. The malady is the illness. And this is an attempt to give us some more information to help us to make this decision on so we can straighten out spiritually. Beautiful, beautiful piece of literature if we look at it that way. He said, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely.
That's because of the obsession of the mind.
Or if, when drinking, you have little control of the amount you take.
That's because of the physical allergy.
You are probably alcoholic. Now, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Only God can remove the obsession to drink. Only. And we might as well know that. So we're getting ready to get some more information so we can have God remove from us this obsession of the mind. Can't do it with willpower. Can't do it with thinking our way out of it. Can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. It's only a spiritual experience will conquer this.
You know, we just love the simplicity of the big book. Two little questions to determine whether you're alcoholic or not. I use them all the time. People come to me and they say, Charlie, do you think I might be an alcoholic? I say, well, I don't know. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Have you been able to quit drinking entirely, left on your own resources? If they're real alcoholic, they've got to say no. And I say, do you have any control over the amount you drink after you once start drinking? If they're a real alcoholic, they've got to say no. And I say, well, then you're probably alcoholic. And it's just that simple. But you know how people love to expand on things. Our fellowship took the two little questions out of the big book, and they decided that wasn't enough. And they brought out a pamphlet that had 10 questions in it to see if you're alcoholic. Later on, they decided that wasn't enough, and they came out with another one that had 20 questions in it to see if you're an alcoholic. Hell, they've got one today. I think it's got 44 questions in it. We only need these two little simple questions. Joe and I had an old friend that used to live in Tyler, Texas. His name was Wino Joe. And I've always felt sorry for anybody in AA that didn't get to meet Wino Joe. He was a real character.
Mm-hmm.
He made up his own list of questions to ask yourself to see if you're alcoholic. And the first question on his list was, has the roof of your mouth ever been sunburned?
While drinking. Joe loved to lay out in those cotton fields out there in East Texas and drink wine. And to lean back and take a little rest with his mouth open. And
His second question was, have you ever been arrested for drunk driving from the back seat of somebody else's car? Yeah. And his third question, I always loved it. He said, have you ever been arrested for public drunk while in jail? He was a character.
They got a question in the 44 questions. Do you drink alone? Well, think about that. If I'm buying, yes. If you're buying, no.
Second paragraph on page 44. To one who feels an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. That is, the spiritual experience. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death.
Step one.
Or to live on a spiritual basis.
Step two.
Are not always easy alternatives to face. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics, and our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. And I think what he's really saying here is, it doesn't make any difference what you believe when you get here. You're still going to be able to have this spiritual experience if you're willing to do certain things. I had to go back and examine what my belief was when I got here. I said, Charlie, are you an atheist? And I said, no. An atheist is one who says there is no God. An atheist has no power greater than human power to turn to. Therefore, the atheist must stand on their own two feet, run their own show, make their own decisions. I said, are you an atheist? And I said, no, I'm not an atheist. I've always believed that there is a God. And I said, well, maybe you are agnostic then. I had to go back to the dictionary and look that word up. And an agnostic is one that is defined as one with no knowledge of God. An agnostic is one who believes there is a God, but acts as if there isn't a God, stands on her own two feet, makes her own decisions, rules their own decisions, and they have no true knowledge of God. They believe in God, but they act like an atheist acts. And I said, are you an agnostic? And I said, you bet your boots I am. Because I've always believed that there was a God. Hell, fire, and damnation. But I always believed there was a God. But I acted as if there was no God and ran my own show and made my own decisions and never turned to God, and therefore I had no knowledge about God. I've never seen a true atheist in AA yet. Even those that say they're atheists, they believe in such things as evolution. And if that isn't evidence of a power greater than human power, I don't know what is. Most of us come here as agnostics. Most of us believe in God. But most of us have been running our own show and act as if we disbelieved in God, even though we did believe. That's certainly what I was. The book says if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. Or we could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, now that's what the atheist and agnostic is working on, human resources. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. And I believe that to be true of every one of us. You see, we didn't come to AA because we wanted to. We didn't take a drink at age 14 and jumped up and down and shouted with joy and said, I can hardly wait to be a member of AA when I'm 38 years old. No, we came here because we didn't have any place else to go. This is the court of last resort. And if you and I could have found the power to solve our problem in any other way, we would not be members of AA today. So lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. It doesn't say which will help you solve it. It doesn't say which will enable you to take care of it. It says the main object is to find a power greater than ourselves, which will solve the problem. And I find, interestingly enough, from page 45 on, we don't talk about alcohol anymore. We're through with that. We talk about one thing and one thing only. For those of us that are powerless, and that's all of us, how do you find the power? And if we can find the power, then the power will solve the problem.
The book says that means we've written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. Here difficulty arises with agnostics, that was me. Many times we talk to a new man, watch his hope rise as we discuss our alcoholic problem and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when he speaks of the spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. We'll reopen the subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. Let's go to page 46, and that's what I thought would happen. I come to AA looking for a solution to my drinking problem. I saw the steps on the wall, and it talked about God, and I said to myself, oh, hell. Thought I've ignored that thing. Here it is again, you see. And our book says here that the first paragraph, yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let's make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were to lay aside prejudice, old ideas, and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. And my little sponsor at that time, a little black guy named George, looked like Sammy Davis Jr. Great guy, he's dead now. Loved him to death. If you knew him, you'd love him too. You couldn't help it. But he told me one time, he said, oh, you're having trouble with this God idea, aren't you? I said, George, I'm having a terrible time. A terrible time. I told him about the time that I went to see my first wife's preacher through a little sober spell trying to get back home. And I went to see her preacher. I was desperate. And I went in to see this guy, and he set me down across the table. And he said, well, Joe, what seems to be your problem? Well, I don't know what my problem is. I haven't been to AA yet. So I told him what I thought my problem was, and it was her. I said, if you live with her, you'd drink too, I told him. And you know those old Southern Baptist ministers down there, they'll give you a solution. And he said, you must, and boy, did he emphasize that word, you must have faith in these things, and he told me what they were. And I got up and I just walked out. I didn't have faith in what he was talking about. How can you have faith in something that you don't even believe? He's asking me to have faith. And I didn't even believe what he was talking about. So I had to walk away, you see. George said, well, Joe, you're trying to turn your will and your life over to that kind of God, and you can't do it. He said, why don't you do what he had done and a number of his friends had done? And he said, you go home tonight and get you a pencil and a piece of paper. Realize that you can't make God. But if you could, what would you want it to be? You see, I didn't know you could do that. Man, you go to hell down there for doing that. You still go to hell down there for doing that. But he gave me permission. And I went home that night. I laid aside the prejudices that I had. Now, if I could make God, what would I want it to be? I wrote some things down on a piece of paper. And the next day I showed it to George. And he said, well, that's good. You can start right there. See, I needed a starting place. George gave me a starting place, and that was the beginning.
If we need the power, we got to know where to start. And on the second paragraph on page 46, it tells us, much to our relief, we discovered we do not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and effect a contact with Him. An old idea cast aside, replaced with a new idea. You know, I was taught that you believed as they believed, or you're going to hell just sure as anything. I was not allowed as a kid growing up to have a God of my understanding. It had to be the God of the Baptist Church understanding. And I'm like Joe, I didn't know you could have your own conception of God. You go to the Southern Baptist Church down in the South, you go to hell for thinking that. But they said that isn't necessarily true. That I can discard that old idea and have my own conception of God. And the instant that I found that I was able to have my own conception of God, then already my ideas about God began to change. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. Another old idea cast aside. I was taught that the way to God is a very, very narrow path. And if you fall off of either side of it, you're going to hell just sure as anything. And this thing says that isn't necessarily true. That God doesn't make too hard turns with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. Another old idea cast aside. I was taught that you had to believe as they believed, or you're going to hell just as sure as anything. And the book is saying that isn't necessarily true. It is open to all men, all inclusive, never exclusive anyhow. Already I'm beginning to discard some old ideas, pick up some new ideas. My thinking about God is beginning to change just through the first two or three pages of this chapter. Let's go to page 47, top of the page.
I told George, I said, George, you mean I got to find God? And he said, Joe, God's not lost. You know? And he said that we found that God does not make too hard of terms with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive, or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It's not in the finding. It's in the seeking. And if I will seek God into my life, He will disclose Himself to me. And I'll have a God of my own understanding, you see. And that's what happens for me. It's in the seeking. It's not in the finding. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice,
old ideas,
you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. That's all I need to do. What do these things mean to me? At the start, this was all that we needed to commence spiritual growth. To affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood Him. And then afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth, but if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. And certainly it was very, very limited. As I look back at this process today, I really never had any trouble with God. I had trouble with other people's idea about God. And they were trying to force it on me. That's where I had the trouble. I couldn't believe as they believed. So I just rejected the whole thing. You see? But if I can start with the God of my own understanding and begin to seek God in my life, my mind opened up and began to see things differently. As I'm 33 years sober now, and my mind is about God is altogether different than it was way back when. I'm different. My life is different. I think differently about it.
We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe? The agnostic has always believed in some kind of God. Or am I even willing to believe? The atheist can become willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself. As soon as a man can say that he does believe, the agnostic, or is willing to believe, the atheist, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Asterisk, bottom of the page. Please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experience. You see this wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we're going to build is really the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. We referred to it back in Bill's story when he said willingness was the foundation of that structure. Now then we see believing is the cornerstone of that structure. So we're already beginning to build the structure. If we can say that we believe there is a power greater than ourselves, or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself?
George said, if you can't find a power greater than yourself, at least find one other than yourself. I can do that.
Now, the book says that was great news for us. For we'd assume we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith, which seemed difficult to believe. Now, right here, he separates those two words. Faith and belief. Faith implies knowledge. Faith implies surety. And a minister always said, son, all you got to do is have faith. I never could have any faith because I just barely believed. You see, I had no knowledge that God would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I had no faith. I just had belief. You can't start with faith. You can only start with belief. And then when certain things happen, belief can change to faith. Let me give you a good example. Let's say I moved into this part of the state here, and maybe 3 or 4 months after I move in here, I've got a problem with my automobile. Now, I don't know a good mechanic anywhere in this area, but you've been here forever, and I assume that you'll probably know a good mechanic. So I go to you and I say, look, I've got a problem with my car. I need to find a good mechanic. Can you recommend anybody? And you say, well, sure. Take your car over there to John. John will do you a good job and he'll charge you a reasonable price. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. The best I can do with that information, if I believe it's strong enough, I'll take my car over there to John. Sure enough, he does a good job and he charges me a reasonable price. When I leave there, I know that he will do so. When I went there, I believed he would do so. Now, the next time I have trouble with my car, I don't ask you or anybody else where to take it. I take it right back to John. Only this time I took it on faith. The first time I took it on belief. You simply cannot have faith to start. You have to start somewhere with belief, and then as things take place, certain things transpire, then you change from belief to faith.
I remember
a very simple idea.
Many years ago, we were having this conversation. I was young in sobriety, and Charlie was going through this, and I said, I couldn't have the faith. In fact, I don't even believe what you're talking about. At least, he said, be suspicious, you know? If you can't have any belief, you can't have any faith, at least be suspicious about it. I could do that, see.
And that's all belief is. It's just a suspicion that maybe that's right and maybe that's not. But we don't know that for sure until after we try.
Yeah. So when people presented us with spiritual approaches, how frequently did we say, I wish I had what that man has? I'm sure it would work if I could only believe as he believes. Thank God for the second step. He said, we came to believe. He didn't say we came to have faith. We came to believe. But I cannot accept surely the many articles of faith which are so plain to him. So it was comforting to learn that we could commence at a simpler level. And certainly mine was a very simple level. Let's go over to page 51 for a moment.
Now we know we need the power. And we know that the beginning of the power, the finding of it, is just to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves. Let's go to page 51. Let's see if we can't see a little bit about perhaps the procedure to find that power.
He said, this world of ours has made more material progress in the last century, this on page 51, than last century, than all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reasons. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. And I used to wonder, why is it that those people 500 years ago don't have televisions and airplanes, cell phones, those kind of things. Are we smarter than they are? And the answer is no. The intellect of men in those days, which means the capacity to learn, was equal to the best of today. So why didn't they learn those things? Well, it said, yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of a materialist mind, men were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. So superstition, tradition, and fixed ideas kept them in the dark ages, so to speak, so they couldn't learn. Right here in America, up in the northeast corner of the United States, some 225 or 30 years ago, people came here for religious freedom. They came here so they could practice their religion freely without any hope of reprisals. And as long as everybody was practicing their religion somewhat like everybody else was, you were okay. If the group conscience, you practiced the group conscience of the area, so to speak. But if you had any ideas that were different than the group conscience of the area, and you expressed them, guess what they did for us? They'd burn you at the stake for being a witch. So if you had any ideas that were different than the group conscience, you wouldn't expound on them because they'd burn you at the stake for being a witch. So superstition and tradition and all sorts of fixed ideas kept us in the dark ages for a long time. Thank God today, I think we've collectively, our minds are open. We can look at almost anything today without the superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Thank God for that.
He said some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth was preposterous. I think Columbus is one of the greatest examples that I know of where you can go from belief to faith if you're willing to turn loose of some old traditions and superstitions and fixed ideas. A little over 500 years ago, what they thought was a civilized world was then centered primarily around the Mediterranean Sea, the western shores of Europe. And they had found a place called the East Indies. In the East Indies, you could get gold and you could get silk and you could get spices and all the goody-goodies of life. But the only way you could get to the East Indies was to sail to the northeast end of the Mediterranean. And then you had to go by land. Camelback, footback, horseback, however they traveled in those days, took years to make that trip. They were trying to find a new trade route to the East Indies so they could get there and get back faster. And somebody said, well, you know, could we sail a ship to the East Indies? They said, well, no, idiot. Don't you know you can only sail to the northeast of the end of the Mediterranean and then you got to go by land? And somebody said, well, what would happen if we sailed the other way? And they said, well, dummy, don't you know that the world is flat? And if you sail out there, you're going to sail right off the edge of this sucker. I don't know why they believed that. I assume some people sailed out there and didn't come back, and they thought they sailed off the edge of it, and the world was stymied right there as far as getting to the east end of the Mediterranean and going to the East Indies. Until Columbus came along.
He was an alcoholic, wasn't he, Charlie?
Now, Columbus had to be. He absolutely had to be alcoholic. He displayed all the mannerisms of an alcoholic. When he left, he didn't know where he was going. That's surely alcoholic. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. That's surely alcoholic. When he got back, he didn't even know where he had been. Surely that's alcoholic. But what really made him alcoholic is a woman financed the whole trip.
Yeah. She did that twice. Yeah.
Columbus was big enough. Columbus was big enough to believe different than everybody else in the world at that time. And based on his belief, he took some action and he got some results. And he changed the maps of the entire world. He changed the history of humankind because he was willing to believe something different. He followed a little formula.
You want to write down these key words.
He followed a little formula that the world has always known. That if you want to change anything, there's certain things that has to take place. The first thing you got to do to change anything is to be willing to change it. Circumstances are what makes people willing to change things. Trying to find a new trade route to the East Indies is what made Columbus willing to change his belief. The second thing you have to do to change anything is to change what you believe. And Columbus said, I don't believe the world's flat. He said, I believe it's round. Made one of the most drunk statements the world's ever heard. He said, I believe we could get east by sailing west. If that isn't drunk thinking, I don't know what is. But his belief didn't do him any good, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that belief. Some days, weeks, months, years later, he did the third thing you have to do to change anything. He made a decision. He said, by golly, I'm tired of standing here worrying about this deal. I'm going to go find out whether this thing is round or flat, if you can really get east by sailing west. But his decision didn't do him any good either, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that decision. Some days, weeks, months, years later, he began to do the fourth thing you have to do to change anything. He began to take some action. He went to the King of Portugal, outlined his plan, and tried to get the money from the King of Portugal. The King of Portugal said, no way am I going to let you have this money. He said, you'll sail out there and sail right off the edge of this sucker and I'll lose every bit of it. That's why he ended up with the Queen of Spain. Sweet talked her out of the money, on the promise that he would bring back gold, silk, and spices. She let him have the money. He bought three ships. He put provisions in those three ships. He put crew members in those three ships. They began to go east by sailing west, day after day after day after day, sailing straight west. Now, we don't know for sure, but we have a strong suspicion that on the first trip, he probably hired a special sailor, put him on a bow of the lead ship at night with a lantern, whispered in his ear, and he said, I believe this thing is round, but if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler so we can get turned around in time. Now, after having taken the action, they got results, and results always come from the action. They found land on the other side. Now, he thought it was the East Indies. We know it wasn't. It was the West Indies. But he had proven to himself that the world is not flat. It is round. You will not sail off the edge of it. He turned right around, came right back to the Queen of Spain. And she said, Columbus, where's the gold, silk, and spices you promised you would bring me? And he said, sweetheart, I'm sorry I didn't find any. But he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you'll refinance me, I'll go back. And this time I'll find them.
Now, trust me, honey.
Trust me, honey. Yeah.
Please.
She gave him more money, and he got more ships, more crew members, more provisions. They began to go east by sailing west day after day after day with one big difference. On the second trip, he didn't hire the special sailor at night, put him on the bow of the lead ship with a lantern. He went back in faith. The first time he believed, the second time he knew. Now, I'd like to sit here today and tell you that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are brand new. The world's never seen anything like them before. But if I did, I'd tell you a lie. Because the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are based on the same formula that Columbus used and any other human being has ever used to change anything. In order for you and I to recover from alcoholism, the first thing we have to do is to become willing. Willingness comes through step one. When we can see what we're doing is no longer going to work, when we've had all of it we can stand, then we become willing to change. That's step one. But being willing to change will do us no good unless we come to believe. And that's step two. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But our belief will do us no good unless we make a decision about it. And that's step three, where we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. But the decision will do us no good unless we take action. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all action steps. As the result of those action steps, we will get results in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I no longer believe that God will restore me to sanity. I know that He will because He's done so. Now, those of us that have had the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, we can go back and help the next newcomer come to believe. Then they can make a decision. They can take action. They'll have a spiritual awakening, and they can go help the next one come to believe. There's only one thing you and I can't do for the newcomer. We cannot make them willing. Willingness is a job they have to work on themselves. How does an alcoholic become willing to change?
Drink a lot of whiskey.
Drinking lots and lots and lots of whiskey, and we become willing to change. That's an inside job. But after they become willing, then we can help them believe, we can help them decide, we can help them act, and then they'll have a spiritual awakening. Such a simple little procedure. I always thought it was a complicated process, but it really isn't. If I know I need the power, and if I know that I can have my own conception of that power, if I know that the beginning of the finding of the power is just to believe or be willing to believe, if I know the procedure to follow to find that power, then I just need to know one more thing. I've got to know, where am I going to find that power? And when I came to AA, I was just as confused about what God is as I were ever confused about what God was. As a kid growing up in church, I got a picture of God in my mind. Now, I don't know whether I saw it or dreamed it, but God in my mind was a tall, elderly gentleman standing on a white cloud up in the sky. Long, flowing white robes on, long, flowing white hair, golden halo around his head, sun rays shooting out of that halo, and a big stick in his right hand.
Looking and booking.
I think the reason I thought God dwelt up there is because I noticed every time the minister talked about God, he always pointed up there. But what really confused me is I noticed every time the minister wanted to talk to God, he looked down here. Hell, no wonder we get confused as kids in church, you know, when we see that kind of stuff. And I looked and I looked and I looked and I never could find God. One reason I couldn't find Him, I said, and didn't know where He dwells. And I didn't know that until I came to page 55 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
On page 55. Yet we've been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world. People rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smile. We'd seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. I was in working in this little halfway house, going down there quite a bit. There was a young man there. I liked him, and he asked me to be his sponsor. And I said, well, I'd be glad to be your sponsor. He said, what do you want me to do? I said, I'd like for you to find a job and get out of this halfway house to start with. Not a good place for you. He said, well, easy for you to say. If I had a car, I could get me a job. I'm quite qualified as a machinist. I said, well, I have a job, and I'll take you back and forth. We'll find one and get you a couple of weeks' worth of pay, and we'll get you an apartment nearby where you work, and you can ride the bus and eventually get a car, which is what we did. But one morning on the way to work, he told me a story that was to change my life. And all the time, I'm thinking I'm helping him. But he told this story to me. It's about the three wise men of the East, the way he put it. And they stole from man and woman the crown of life, the thing that would make us the happiest. And he said, well, what are we going to do with it, they said. Well, one of them said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take it to the highest mountain on the face of the earth. We'll hide it in the highest crevice, and they'll never be able to find it there. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt and they'll search and they'll eventually find it. The other said, well, we'll take it to the deepest ocean and deepest crevice in the ocean and hide it there. They'll never be able to find it there. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt and they'll search and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll hide it within himself, and he'll never look for it there. And our book says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship, by other things, but in some form or other, it's there. For faith in the power greater than ourselves, a miraculous demonstration of that power in human lives, are facts as old as man himself. See, we're just born with it. It's always been there. As much as I tried to deny it, it's always been there. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, only there that it may be found. And it was so with us.
You know, today we believe that every human being on earth is born with some form of basic knowledge, probably lying at a subconscious level. And that knowledge seems to be able to tell us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And I know in my particular case, it's been there as far back as I can remember. There used to be times I would be getting ready to do something, and some little voice from within me would speak to me and say, "Charlie, I don't think you ought to be doing this." I wouldn't pay a bit of attention to it. I'd go ahead and do it and just get in one hell of a mess. And that same little voice would say, "See, I told you not to do that in the first place." Now, if that's true, and if that dwells within me, then I think probably I'm beginning to look at the idea that maybe I could have my own personal God. Now, some people might want to call that knowledge the conscience. Some might want to call it the soul. Some might want to call it common sense. I don't think we really makes any difference what we call it, as long as we realize it's there. Now, if that idea is God, then what that means to me is that God dwells within me. And if God dwells within me, then I've got my own personal God. I don't worry anymore about whether he's the God of the Baptist Church, the Catholic Church, the Hebrew religion, the Muslim God, or anybody else's God. If he dwells within me, he's my own personal God. And he and I can come together in very simple and very understandable terms. That's one of the greatest pieces of information I've ever learned in my lifetime. Now then, having learned this information, having studied this chapter, having discarded some old ideas about God, and began to pick up some new ideas about God, am I now ready to make a decision? You betcha I am. Without this chapter, I could never have made it. Thank God for chapter 4, We Agnostics.
Remember when
it opened the door for me to make my decision.
Remember when we read in the Spiritual Experience back on page 569? He said, "With few exceptions, our members find they've tapped an unsuspected inner resource." It's just always been there. We had an atheist, he said he was, there in Tulsa one time, and someone suggested we take him down to that 55-floor building and throw him off the top. And I said, "I bet before he hits the concrete, he'll holler, 'Oh God.'" And why would you do that? Because it's just there. It's always been there, as much as we tried to deny it. This next little paragraph sums up the chapter, We Agnostics. He said, "We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, old ideas, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself. Then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail." Now get this. "The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you." In other words, you'll have a God of your own understanding. Father Bill said he, the Pope, or nobody else could ever improve upon that understanding. Once you get that understanding, nobody could improve upon it. Turns out to be that way. Thank God for this chapter, We Agnostic. Beautiful chapter. Beautiful chapter.
I can see old Bill again sitting down at the end of chapter 4, reviewing what he's done up to this point. He probably says to himself, "I was able to show them the problem in the doctor's opinion and my story, Bill's story. I was able to show them the solution, the two powers in chapter 2. I was able to show them what's going to happen to them if they don't find that power in chapter 3 because of their insanity. I was able to give them some new ideas about that power, so they'll be able to make a decision in chapter 4. And he says, I think I've done all I need to do now, to show them the problem and show them the solution. And now then it's time to get down to the main object of the book, he says. It's now time for me to show them how they're going to find that power, the program of action necessary to find that power. And Bill sits down and he begins to try to write chapter 5, how it works. And he had a lot of difficulty with it for two or three reasons. They were having a lot of trouble, not particularly with God, but with different people's ideas and opinions about God. Most of the people that were coming in were probably Protestants or Catholic. We had a sprinkling of Jewish people beginning to show up. We had some Muslim people beginning to come in. And he's getting ready to write a set of directions on how to find God, and how in the hell are you going to do that without offending some of these people. Also, they had made a little six-step program out of the Oxford Group program, and Bill felt that that program needed to be expanded. There was loopholes in it that the alcoholic mind was slipping through, and it needed to be tightened and expanded in order to close those loopholes. And he said he tried and he tried and he tried and he tried to start on chapter 5. Just could not get it going. And he said one night, while in bed, pillow behind his back, leaning against the headboard, pad and pencil in hand, trying to write chapter 5, he said, I finally just gave up. And said, I put the pad and pencil down and I closed my eyes and turned to God and asked God for help, the right thought, the right direction, and etc. He said, I prayed and meditated for approximately 10 or 15 minutes. And he said, then I picked up the pad and pencil, and it felt as if the pencil had a mind of its own as it raced across the pages. In less than 30 minutes, he had written how it works, the thing that we read at all of our AA meetings today. Now, Joe is going to read to you how it works, but it's not going to be from your big book. It's going to be from the original how it works as he wrote it that night, before the other members got hold of it and forced him to change some of it. And I think you'll be able to see just exactly what Bill had in mind. I think you'll also be able to see just exactly what the other members objected to. And I think Joe, by changing the tone of his voice or by pausing, will be able to point out the differences if you'll go through how it works with him. Joe?
It says, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps which we took which are suggested as your program of recovery. One, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our life over the care and direction of God as we understood Him.
Over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. Remember that. We'll be referring to it later on.
Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly, on our knees, asking to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now you may exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is they're willing to go along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic.
That's the doctor's opinion. Bill's story. Some of it in chapter 2 and 3.
The chapter 2, the agnostic.
Chapter 4.
And our personal adventures before and after.
Bill's story and those in the back of the book.
Have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. Well, Bill was a salesman. He's sell us an idea. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step one.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Part of step two.
C, that God can and will.
The rest of step two.
Now, if you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
What could be more clear? You know, it's evident that Bill didn't intend for this to be a set of suggestions. He intended for it to be a set of directions. A set of directions to the individual alcoholic on how to recover from alcoholism. And that's when the crap hit the fan. Because remember, he had to show it to the other members. And when they saw the word directions, they immediately said, "No, sir. You have no right to give anybody directions, period. You can't tell anybody what they're going to have to do, period." And he said, "You're standing there saying you got to do this and you got to do that," and he said, "You can't do that." And they said, "Also, Bill, this sounds too much like the Oxford Group absolutes, where in step seven you're saying holding nothing back, period. Hell, we can't ever get perfect." And they said, "Humbly on your knees is too much like the Oxford Group stuff. You need to change some of that." And Bill said, "No, I don't think so." He said, "I'm not going to change any of this." And they said, "Oh, yeah, you are too." They said, "Remember, this is not your book, it's our book. And we have the right to insist on whatever we find is necessary." He said, "Yeah, but I'm not going to change." And they said, "Yes, you are." He said, "You guys don't understand." He said, "These aren't my words anyhow." He said, "These came after prayer and meditation. These are God's words." And they said, "We don't give a damn whose words they are. It's our book and you're going to change it." And the fight was on. They almost destroyed the little fellowship. Certainly almost destroyed the book project based on these things that they objected to so strenuously. And finally, Bill had enough common sense to realize that if they're ever going to get on with the book, that he's going to have to compromise with them. There was a non-alcoholic psychiatrist around in those days, and he suggested, he said, why don't you change it from directions to suggestions? You'll still get your message across, and more people will probably accept it. And he said, where you keep saying, you, don't do that. He said, say, this is what we had to do, not what you have to do. Change it from you to we. More people will probably accept your book. And where you keep saying, you must do this, don't do that. Change it to the word ought, and more people will probably accept your book. Today we don't know. If they hadn't made those changes, instead of 2 million worldwide today, we might have 10 million. By the same token, if they hadn't made the changes, instead of 2 million worldwide today, we might only have 10,000. Hell, who knows? Nobody knows. We just know that this was the history behind this particular writing of the book. But Bill was cunning and baffling and powerful too. Because he said to them, okay, I'm going to compromise with you, but you guys are going to have to compromise with me. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, I'm tired. He said, I've sent you everything up to this point. You objected to many things. I've had to go back and change them. I'm not going to go through this anymore. He said, if you want me to finish the book, then you give me the authority to do so. And if you don't want to give me the authority, then you finish the book. Well, they didn't want to give him that authority, but they didn't want to have to finish the book either. Very reluctantly, they agreed to give him the authority to finish the rest of the book. Now, what he knew, but what they didn't know, is 2 pages later, he's going to put directions right back in the book. He's going to put you and must right back in the book. He's had it up to this point. They jerked it out of how it works. He turns around and puts it right back in, and it ruined some of the continuity of the book. But now that we can see what transpired, we can see what he really had in mind. The other thing I think that is so clear, where he said our description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostic, our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you 3 pertinent ideas. A, that you're alcoholic and cannot manage your life. Step 1. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. Step 2. C, that God can and will, still a part of step 2. And he said, if you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. So it's evident that the first 2 steps, all the information for them will be found in the doctor's opinion and the first 4 chapters. You know, if I can say to myself today, you betcha, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life has become unmanageable, then I'm through with step 1. If I can say to myself today, you betcha, I believe there's a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, then I'm through with step 2. But you see, I never could say those things without the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters because I didn't know what alcoholism was. So how could I know I'm powerless over it if I don't know what it is? I didn't believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. First place, I didn't think he would. In the second place, I didn't understand the insanity. But now that I've read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters, I'm convinced on those first 2 steps, and it's not by accident. The very next statement in the big book says, being convinced, we're now at step 3. You see, this is the fallacy in trying to start a new person in chapter 5, because it starts with 3. And you can't hardly make the decision unless you've got 1 and 2 behind you, and that comes from the first part of the book.
It's kind of amazing. Yeah, it's kind of amazing to note that how much they thought of steps 1 and 2. They used the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters to do 1 and 2. We're going to take a break here in a minute and do step 3, and you're only going to use 4 pages. Doctor's opinion, first 4 chapters, 1 and 2, 4 pages to do step 3. Most important to get this information 1 and 2 behind us, because they spend an awful lot of time doing that.
Let's take about a 15-minute break, and we'll jump right into step 3 and 4 for the rest of the day. The winning ticket is still on the roll. Nobody has bought it yet. So if you want the book, you better go buy it.